Thank you. What a great welcome. Can you hear me? Is the microphone on? Great. So welcome, everyone. We drove down from Oregon yesterday, and when we left our home, we got up early in the morning and we had breakfast. It was 1 below 0 Fahrenheit, and there were, about 4 feet of snow on the ground where we were eating breakfast. So I know many of you are shivering out there, but I have to tell you, to me, this just feels like summertime. So I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, Judith, for that warm welcome. And I look forward to spending these couple of hours with you. And I want to begin with a reflection. Judith told me that's your tradition of moving inside so that you can be present to listening, not just a bunch of information and facts, but really life wisdom from the inside, from the soul side out. So I'm going to tell you a little story, and then I'll invite you to close your eyes. And this would be good if you just kind of cleared your laps for a minute, didn't have anything you were holding in your hands. And I'll tell you about this wonderful tradition. The artist who sings this song, her name is Lorena McKennett. She's a Canadian Celtic artist. And back in the 1980s, she discovered this poem on a train trip across Siberia. And a grandmother was singing this song to her little grandchild. And she couldn't believe that it was being sung in Irish, Old Irish. And, of course, the Celts went everywhere, including to the steppes of Russia. But the story is, the song, the poem, is about 1,000 years old. It's an Anamkara poem, a soul friend poem. Anamkaras are midwives. And this woman was pregnant with her first child. And her midwife, who was nurse and spiritual guide, could tell that the baby was not going to live. So she creates this poem in that moment so that the mother will have it forever. And in a way, what she's doing is celebrating the beginning and end of life together. But rather than that being a sad, terrible experience, it becomes a profound experience. And it's out of that that she writes this poem, this song called Please Remember Me. So if you're comfortable, you can put your hands close to your heart. And if you want to close your eyes, see if the memory of someone beloved to you who has passed comes to you. Don't try so much to remember someone, but see if their memory comes into your heart center. And this will work better if you can close your eyes and just really go inside and listen to the words here, Please Remember Me.
Thank you.
take some deep breaths now before you open your eyes and come back to this space. The old Celts would say we just doubled the population of the room. When we remember that way, it's not just memory, distant past, it's a kind of real presence. So I'd love to begin that way because it takes us right into the deep end of a different way of seeing. The Celtic tradition, I think, is, as John Philip Newell says, and John O'Donohue and other Celtic teachers, is in some ways a rope of hope for aspects of Christianity that don't seem to be working anymore. And the problem is never Christianity, it's the man-made structures around it. And the Celtic vision gives us a whole radically different way of seeing through to that. And that's what I hope I can share with you here this morning. It's wonderful that in the book that you're reading, so much of it is telling stories about Iona. I love taking people to Iona. It's really, I think, one of the great places on the planet. It's one of the thin places, the Irish call it, the Celts call it, thin place. You just have a sense there that you're not just really on the planet in the same way as you are driving around anywhere else. And over the years, as we've taken groups there, we've enjoyed introducing people. I always love to take them there and stay for enough of a period of time, at least a week, so that you really, really can drink in the rocks of Iona. And I've got baskets here of rocks. I'm going to pass them around to you in a few minutes because I want you to feel an Iona rock. They are the oldest rocks exposed on the planet. And John talks about that in his book, doesn't he? Could be, some say, as old as 3 billion years. There's only five places on the planet where that rock is exposed, from the beginning of the formation of Earth. And Iona is the only place where the entire island is made out of that rock. So I always say when you're walking on it, you feel as though you still feel the vibration of the Big Bang. And when you touch an Iona rock, maybe you feel the sense a little bit of that. So the abbey there goes back to the 5th century to St. Columba, but it's had an interesting up and down history. It has been a checkered history. There's been a lot of violence during the Reformation. The abbey was burned and destroyed. And then a Presbyterian pastor in the early 20th century wanted to make it a home for spiritual renewal. And that has really taken fire there. And young people now come to the Iona community from all over the world in the summertime to make commitments to social justice and to the environment and to important causes. So the abbey, once again, is vibrant in the 21st century. And when we go to Iona, we love to teach people about the five great elements of the Celtic healing tradition. And that's how I'm going to structure this little time with us here this morning and take you for a tour. And you're going to see how they dovetail with, I think, the chapters in the Rebirthing of God book that you're reading. So it'll give you some dovetail with what you're reading and maybe some new information as well. Beginning with this point I call a marriage of cultures. If you know anything at all about the Celts, it's interesting. I'm 100% Polish and Lithuanian, so a Slav. And last year, one of my kids gave me the Ancestry.com DNA test, and I found out I was 30% Celtic. And I thought, not with names like Wojciechowski and my name was actually Grozinski. How could that be? And it's because those Celts really did go everywhere. You can't go to the Slavic countries, you can't go to the Middle East even, and not find parts of the Celtic tradition. So just a little remnant of that is in the language itself, in the Irish language, which I've been trying to study through the University of Galway for the last 5 years, and it's a tough, tough language to study. But you find in the old sacred words like anam, which is the word for soul, in Irish, Anam Kara, soul friend, that it's related to the old Indian Sanskrit Atman. The Atman and the Brahman are one. So some of the oldest spiritual language on the planet tells us that the Celts originally, these were traveling gurus who came out of India 4,000 years ago and moved across Europe, across the land bridge, and eventually ended up in the Celtic lands. And these druids, who were the aboriginal Celtic teachers, and by the way, forget anything that anyone has ever said to you about the druids, especially if, like me, you were raised in a pious Christian home, you were told the druids were evil, bloodthirsty, you know, pagans, and witches and so forth. The quite opposite is true. In fact, the Julius Caesar and the early Greek and Roman writers said that these were the most spiritually evolved people that they had ever encountered. They said they were the only culture on the planet 2,000 years ago that treated men and women equally. 2,000 years ago. So this tradition going back to India, and the only reason I can stand here and John Philip Newell can write his book to talk to you about Celtic Christianity is because that's the map of the farthest extent of the Roman Empire in the early 5th century. The shaded area was how far the empire had extended, and pretty much outside of that was just the, you know, the unknown world. But you notice that the island of Ireland and north of Hadrian's Wall in Scotland, the Romans never conquered. And thank goodness they never conquered, because they would have Romanized it, and instead this fierce culture, even in spite of all the centuries of persecution by the English and everything else, they held fiercely to a whole very different way of seeing the world. So I say that what we're really talking about today, and John Philip Newell agrees with me on this, is not just, we often hear Judeo-Christian tradition, we see that hyphenation, but we're talking about a Druidic Judeo-Christian spirituality. In other words, we're talking about a spirituality in some ways that will have more in common with our native peoples here in North America, your Chumash perspectives, than they will with the Greco-Roman world. And that's why it's such a radically non-dual vision of Christianity. And that's why it's emerging. It's so different than some of the narrow categories that sometimes the Christian message has been poured into. So even, I see there we're meeting at a good Presbyterian church, so the Presbyterian cross, which is the sun cross, is the Celtic cross. It's a pre-Christian symbol. It was back way before Patrick ever came to Ireland. The sun cross was there already on grave markers in Scotland and Ireland and in Wales, because it represented the four directions. It represented here belongs everything. When you stand at the middle, which is your center, your soul, and you extend to north, south, east, and west, what you do is invite every perspective to be part. It's a hospitality tradition that says, how can I learn from every wisdom tradition on the planet? That was the Celtic passion. They said there's wisdom everywhere. And they took it and they incorporated it and they made it their own. So this is an example outside of the Iona Abbey. It's one of the tall pilgrim crosses. This is one of St. Martin's cross, very, very tall, intact, from, they think, the 8th century. It's been there a long time. On the side facing west, you'll find carved into the cross biblical stories of Abraham and Noah and Moses and Miriam and so forth. And on the east facing side of the cross, you'll find native Druid symbols. The cross on both sides having both. The east side facing the rising sun, the sacred direction of the aboriginals, and the west side, the symbol of Western Christianity, incorporated together on the cross. Can you imagine today in a church if you tried putting a cross up there and said, well, we're going to put pagan symbols on one side now, and, oh, yeah, really? Uh-huh, yeah, so try a different parish, right? So, but here it was, embedded already, because they said, we don't want to lose what our ancestors believed. So we say pagan and it sounds horrible, you know, if you've been trained that way. To them it meant no, it meant an honoring of the elements, an honoring of the earth, an honoring of the animals, an honoring of the larger creation, a creation nature-based spirituality. That's what was preserved in the Celtic imagination. So they were smart people. They knew that they were being watched by bishops from the continent who weren't too happy with this mix of old and new. So they took their famous characters from history, like Merlin, ever hear of him? You know, and they just morphed Merlin or Angus into St. Andrew. They said, well, yeah, we know, the saints, right? But there was like a code language. Okay, so underneath, you didn't have to lose the stories of the ancient and the new. This is there at the Iona Abbey, and it's in the nunnery. And I love this, the description of the nunnery chapel that Newell has in his first chapter of the book, that he says it's in some ways more sacred to him than the Abbey church because there's no roof on it. You know, and I always take people as where we always do our liturgies there. Because if it's raining, well, isn't that wonderful? You know, we're in touch with the elements. But one of the little-known facts, and actually the Christian guides won't tell you this too much, is what you find over the convent doors. This was a woman's monastic settlement. It's the Shila Nagig. Anybody ever hear of a Shila Nagig? Okay, some of you wouldn't have. Okay. And you find them all over the Celtic monasteries. And they're only in women's monasteries. This is the door over the entrance into the monastery. You find, this is the stone embedded here. And here you can see a little, an enlargement of another one from the other side. It's, Shila is the Irish word for woman. She's pregnant, and she's naked over the door. Her legs are straddling the entrance to the door as she's giving birth to what is entering into the monastery. Now, can you imagine finding a Roman Catholic convent with a Shila Nagig over it? Actually, the IHNs over here at La Casa probably would. They're very progressive. But that's how in these old traditional Benedictine monasteries, this is how unafraid they were of human nature. Imagine. And how did it happen then that particularly in Ireland, with the incursion of Jansenism and other European movements, Christianity became so uptight about sexuality and overly judgmental and rigid? It's not the Celtic spirit. It was imposed on them from the continent, and it's not part of their original spirit at all. So when I say that's one of the great qualities of... I always like to bring show and tell items, by the way. I'm going to pass this around. This is... it's going to look like a Celtic cross. You're going to see a Celtic woven design in the silver. This is an 8th century cross. I'll start it here, and then we can pass it around and then take it to the other side. And it actually comes from Egypt. It's a Coptic cross, but the artwork in it is Celtic. In the oldest North African Christian communities, which are some of the oldest in the world, the Celts were already there, and that's how they took Christianity from that part of the world, the Middle East, to Ireland and Scotland and Wales. By the way, that's a beautiful piece. It would be used in the hospices. It was put over the person's mouth and nose when they were dying. It's called an osculatum. And it would catch the last breath of the person dying. So imagine for centuries you had a tradition of people dying with that cross, and it still had the vibration of the last breath. And so it was considered a very, very sacred item. These items are being destroyed today in the Middle East. And so this one was literally smuggled out by an art dealer friend of mine in Santa Fe, New Mexico. But a Celtic-Egyptian connection, marriage of cultures. The point, though, that you've been mostly reading about in your first chapter, this notion of nature as teacher, is the part I really wanted to spend some time on, because John just sets it up so nicely there in his book. And he's absolutely right. And my friend and dear spiritual friend, John Donahue, who helped us found our program at the center up in Oregon, used to love to quote this phrase of St. Kevin of Glendalough: nature is the face of God, spirit is the invisible God, in us they become one. The whole notion of approaching nature as a good thing, not a fallen state from which we need to be redeemed. This is the biggest divide between continental Christianity that becomes Roman Christianity and Celtic Christianity. And for 1,000 years, up until the 11th century, the Celts fiercely held on to their version. And their main teacher, who was a contemporary of St. Augustine in the 4th century, his name was Bishop, they call him Saint in Ireland, Pelagius. And Pelagius couldn't believe the things that Augustine was writing. Couldn't believe it. Augustine wrote, for example, do you know how sin comes into the world? Every time a man and woman have sex, that is how evil and mortal sin comes into the world. The act itself is that corrupt. Well, you know, where do you go from there? And, of course, then Augustine developed his favorite theory, and it's not in the Bible at all, of original sin. It has nothing to do with biblical teaching. Biblical teaching is Genesis. In the beginning, it was good. God made it good. So Pelagius and the Celts were horrified by that. They said, it's about original blessing, not original sin. How did you warp it? But the Pope was a friend of Augustine. So the dogma that took over from the 4th century on was Augustinian, again, not biblical, but Augustinian Christianity, that begins to see sex as wrong, women as the problem. All of our huge broken issues, it's hard to believe in the 21st century, we're still even struggling with these issues of inclusive language. Had we followed Pelagius, we wouldn't have gone there at all. All the Celtic saints taught something quite, quite different. Nature is not a fallen state from which we need to be redeemed. We are nature. We're part of nature. How could we say that this is bad, that God made it and it's bad? That would be to warp Genesis. So Kevin would say, who is a contemporary of Pelagius, he says, if you're broken, if you're hurting, if you're wounded, your life's messed up, just go out there into nature. Get out of the city. The love of nature can heal the deepest wounds. And that's why all of the Irish mystics, the men and the women from this early time, 5th, 6th century, all lived not in cities, they lived out in nature as far as possible from the crowds. So maybe some of you know Esther Duval, another wonderful Celtic teacher. She does. She's from Wales, actually. But she says, the Celtic approach to God, I love this, opens up a world in which nothing is too common to be exalted, and nothing is so exalted it cannot be made common. If you can't find God in the blade of grass and the flower, why do you think you're going to find God in gold-gilt cathedrals? That's the Celtic spirituality. So that, you can see how it sets things on a path that are very, very different. And the writings of the Celtic mystics and saints, which are being rediscovered today, I think are part of a movement that could be called the rebirthing of God. A rediscovery of God. I can't tell you how many people who have told me over the years, who have done our pilgrimages to Ireland, to Iona, who said, you know, I was just about ready to give up on Christianity. I just didn't know if I could take it anymore. And I discovered a way, a path back to completely belong, to see what Jesus really taught with new eyes for the first time. Now, the Celts, like you heard in that opening song, Rarity spoke in words like this. They didn't give sermons. They wrote poetry. And their poetry was often set to music. And those early Christian saints, Columba, Bridget, Kevin, and so forth, took the Druid poetry of their time and just morphed it into beautiful Christian poetry. But they didn't lose the essence of it. Like this poem. I am a stone of the mountain. I am a feather of the raven. I am a flame of the earth. I am a wave of the ocean. I am a shadow across the face of the moon. Who is the I? God? Who else? We? What else? Those parts of nature. You don't separate them. They're absolutely integral. And that begins to move you into a whole... Once that's your starting point, you approach the world very, very differently. So this is on the beach. It's called Columba's Bay in Iona. It's where his little clerk landed his boat. He was exiled from Ireland, actually, and headed up to Scotland, and this is the first place he landed. And you'll find these stone labyrinths there on the beach, but they're not the Chartres labyrinths that we use. They're the Celtic labyrinths, because Celtic labyrinths are much, much older. And they are symbols of journeys from the outer world to the inner world, to the inner world. So I'll pass around my Iona stones. I don't usually bring these around, but I just thought this time I should bring them. Did she? Oh, good. Well, then you've already touched one. So when you touch one, there's a bunch of this. You can all, you just want to make sure you give them back to me. It's bad juju to steal Iona stones. But there's not one for everybody, unfortunately, but I want you at least to hold one, because they are these 3 billion year old rocks. There's nothing else like it. Okay. And so they have that, they possess that special kind of property about them. And people will go there and they collect those rocks and they'll make jewelry out of them and so forth. And the other thing that you know, you're near a monastery or a thin place or sacred well or sacred site in Ireland or Scotland, because they're always, the entrance to them are always these ancient yew trees, some of the oldest trees on the planet, that are actually the entryway into the cemetery or the sacred place. And they have been there in Druid times. The word Druid means oak tree, means tree. It's where they did their sacred ceremonies and rituals. And then the Christians came and they built their churches in those places. But the whole thing was to observe nature, to allow nature, the calendar of the year, to lead our spiritual lives. And all I'm going to say about this as a whole talk in itself is that we're coming up to February 1st, which is one of the four great seasons, feast days of the Celtic year, Bridget's Day on February 1st. And it's actually the first day of spring in the Celtic tradition. Those of us up in Oregon really appreciate that. Like, there's some hope that maybe things will green up again eventually. But I'm going to talk to you about Bridget, and I'm going to talk to you about her story as Anamkara, because it's remarkable. And John Philip Newell will talk to you a bit about her in his book as well. And it's just perfect timing, because we're right here in that time of the year when we're coming up to the 1st of February, where nature begins to lead us out of the dark places into the light. All right, enough talking about it. I want you to experience it again. Celtic spirituality is experiential. This is a poem set to music, sung in Old Irish. If you were to translate it, there it is. The mist, the dew, the mist, the dew, in the eye of my love, in the eye of my love. And you'll hear it being sung here. I'm going to invite you to close your eyes. Imagine a misty, frosty morning. can almost do that out there this morning. Imagine the mists rising over the water. Imagine you're in the cemetery where your most beloved, dear soul friend is buried. And you miss her. You miss him so bad. And nature itself almost seems to be weeping. And when you touch your cheek, you can't tell whether it's the mist from the outside or whether it's your tear. It all becomes one. You become part of nature. Listen to the energy of this. Druid prayer. Animal creed, from my heart, which is crying, weeping. The tears are not just tears of sadness and sorrow. They're tears of joy. My love for you was so great that I gladly bear the sadness of your loss. Because every time my heart breaks, it tells me how much I love you. Feel the energy of that. Just vibrates through you. Take a deep breath and open your eyes. It's like when you're grieving. Nature is sympathetic. You can get out into nature and you just feel a sense of the universe supporting you. You sense that? It's a beautiful good grief poem set to music that allows you just to utterly feel your grief more deeply and not be afraid of it. One other little piece I want to teach you about before we take our break, and I hope this would be maybe the most helpful takeaway for you today. The threshold to other worlds, the third element of the Celtic healing tradition. Once you understand that this is a tradition that says everything belongs, learn from the universe of spiritual wisdom, that nature is the primary teacher, then it leads you up to this point of threshold. Threshold is liminal space where you're still in one world and you're about to step into a new world. So the Celts really loved that notion and they played with it. They played with it. Their favorite prayer that was brought from the earth was the Lord's Prayer. As above, so below. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Because there is no separation between earth and heaven. They said, when Jesus taught that, he was a good Celt. He was a good Celt. Not that the below is bad and the above is high. It's a very, almost kind of Pauline theology. Get rid of the flesh. Just try to go to spirit. That's very Platonic. But what you find is Jesus is walking around holy mountain, holy well, holy tree, holy this, holy that. He's like an Indian. He's just pointing out, learn from everything. Learn from nature. So you find, this is my wife Mary, at Bridget's Wishing Rock in Kildare, Ireland. The women go there, and they put their hands through the rock. This is the cornerstone of the church. But it was an old Druid stone. It was a rite of initiation for young women. And whatever it is that they wish for, Bridget Breda, we'll talk about her after our little break here, brings it so, because if it's coming from the heart and soul, it's coming from God and it will become true. So it's one of those thin places. You find still in the Celtic lands, there's on Iona, these Iron Age, imagine going back to the Iron Ages, fire temples that are retreat houses underground. Okay. And you would go into the retreat house called the Volva. You would make a retreat your retreat in the fetus house. You would have to go back into the fetal position and go back and be reborn from the earth, was the idea. Whenever you were going to make a major decision in life, you would return to one of these retreat houses. Well, when the monks, the Irish monks, began to create Irish Christianity, notice the monastery is here, but when the novice needs to be initiated, see where he's being sent? Into the ground. Into the old Iron Age temple. St. Patrick said, don't cover those up. Those have been holy places for a long time. Go there into the earth and still learn and discover the wisdom of the Mother. And then this wonderful, to go to Rome, okay, much trouble, little profit. Just stay here in your own backyard. Just, you know, why go there and see gold guild people dressed in robes? Why not just go out to the woods, see, and just discover God? So this is, I think, the most brilliant teaching from the old Irish tradition. And I bring it to you from a Scottish teacher, Fionn Tullock, who teaches in our Anamkara program. If you can imagine a worldview as three concentric circles. Think of those old Russian nesting dolls. You know, you have a little one and a bigger one and a bigger one and a bigger one. The outer ring is the world of nature. They call it Cruna in Old Irish. It's this world. Most of us begin to encounter God, creation, through the five senses and through the beauty of creation. And that's how a child learns, through warmth and touch and food and so forth. So we all have to begin. This world of nature is not a bad world. It's not a fallen, horrible world. Run from nature. Your human nature is bad. It's where you learn. It's where you're schooled about the divine. But that's not enough. Then as you mature and your soul develops, you move into, in meditation practice and so forth, the world of Altar, the middle world. Just go see the Ring movies. Okay, it's all about this. The world of psyche, the world of soul. This is where Anam is grown. Anam is soul. You grow your soul in this tradition, in that middle world. You need an Anamkara, a soul friend who will help you grow soul, who teaches you not that that world of nature is bad, but that there is this other world. It's the world of metaphor. It's the world of poetry and music and the arts, the world of symbol. It's the world of the psyche. And in that middle world, you do your spiritual practice so that eventually you can move to the lip, the edge of the middle world, which is the world of Niart, the world of God, the world of Creator. Niart is an Irish word that means nothing. Nada. There's no thing there. Not like it's not important, but the things drop away. And all there is in silence is the world of spirit. So the goal is to live in all three worlds simultaneously. Good spiritual practice. The Celtic prayer beads, and I'll pass this one around. It's from Iona. It's got the Celtic cross on it. Predates the rosary by 800 years. Much, much older. 150 beads representing the 150 islands to the west that all of us have to travel until we die. And each group of 50 with a divider bead represents the movement from one world to the next. So when I pray this with a simple prayer, I travel through all three worlds. You pray this at 12 noon when your life has been very, very busy. And this reminds you not to forget all three worlds. So it's a beautiful pattern, they call it in Irish, a prayer bead tradition, where you just use a simple phrase, like a centering prayer, and you pray that 150 times with your breath. And it reminds you not to forget. If you've been too busy at the office, and you've been too much in the outer world of nature, then it's time to quiet down and listen more to the soul, see? And eventually, and some say in times of mystical experience and at the time of death, we actually push up to the lip of Nearsht. We get a peek at the other side, and we see that there's this other world of creation. I'm going to show a film from John O'Donohue at the end here where he talks about entering into that third and final world. So isn't that a beautiful way of seeing the world and the universe? You see how non-dual it is. It's not this is bad and that's right. Everything belongs here. What an amazing psychology and spirituality flows out of that kind of perspective on life. But, again, you can talk about it. It's one thing. I want you to experience it. So as we go into our break, I want to teach you an embodied Celtic blessing. Now, I'm talking about the Celts in such glowing terms, you'd think there was no such thing as evil and darkness. And there was. They knew it. And they had powerful, powerful prayers and incantations and blessings to protect you from evil. It's a dangerous world out there. You never knew when an evil spirit swooped down on you, you know, after a political election, and God only knows what happened to you. I'm not making any commentary. I'm just saying. But you never know. There's threatening forces out there. And so there's the need to continually be fortified. So the way they did it were with these blessings that are called Aranturas. They're prayers set to music, poems set to music, done in the body, so that you keep all three worlds together. And I'm going to teach you how to do it, and we're going to do it. We're going to spin in the room here. You'd be like Celtic dervishes. Everybody can do this, even if you're challenged a little bit. That's right. You can do it just seated in your heart. And I'm going to explain it, and then we'll do it, and let the music take care of it. So the poem, the prayer, is called Cain Agus Cruach. Cain is the old Irish word for grace, for love, for protection. Cain is related to the Hebrew word l'chaim, life force, energy. Agus is just the Irish word for and. Cruach is a little boat. Coracle is the little skin boats that they used to go out fishing in the water. And of course, sometimes the waters were calm and peaceful, and sometimes they were turbulent, just like life. My little skin boat sometimes is just floating along fine, and sometimes, don't you know, is really, really upset. So when it's really upset, what I need to do is have my Anamkara remind me to do a blessing. Now, it's a blessing and it's an exorcism at the same time. It chases out the evil, protects us, and it brings in the light. So in the Celtic direction, the moonwise direction is the exorcism direction. That's the direction of darkness. And the sunwise direction is the direction of light. So we spin three times in the moonwise direction, and then three times in the sunrise direction. And what you're going to do is your one hand is going to be pointed up. I'll walk you through it. And your other finger is going to be pointing like you're a human compass. Okay? And you are going to be led around in a circle, and you're like drawing a circle around you, saying, no evil may come in here. No harm can touch me. Okay? That's the blessing of St. Columba on Iona. And then we'll switch in three times. This finger will point down, and this hand reaches up for grace for the heavens, and bring in all the light, all the blessing that I need today. Three times one way, three times the other, and the seventh time, always seven, sacred number, you stand still, you hold your hands close to your heart, and you end the St. Columba of Iona blessing. Would you like to try it? You can do this for yourself. Maybe you've got a friend who's in trouble. You can do it for them. You can do it for the country, for the world. Just saying. Okay, so stand up, and you've got to... Now, again, if you're physically challenged, you can do this seated. We'll have you do it around your heart, and that's really okay. If you don't want to get dizzy. You don't want to get dizzy. And what you'll do is you'll just draw around your heart the circle, those of you who are seated, okay? Now, you need to be spread out there so you're not bumping into each other's kind fields, okay? So, yeah, you're gonna spin with your hands extended, so you can just imagine you want to sort of have that space between you and the other person. You can fill up the whole room here. Yeah? There you go. Great. And you'll hear it sung by this woman in Scotland. She'll start off with an opening prayer, which is kind of a blessing. And then she'll sing, and then after a while, because seven times, you can sing along with it if you like. If you've got a good voice, that would be wonderful to do, to add your voice to it as well. Okay. So, we're going to start with our left hand pointing out, and our right hand up. Okay, there you go. And, again, if you're sitting in a chair, you can just do this. Sitting in a chair, you can make circles around your heart. The intention is more important than the actual action, if you see it that way. All right. And just relax into it. Real slow steps, slow circles. We're moving in the moonwise direction, asking for protection, that no evil could touch us, no harm could touch us. And we make one full circle right about there. So that's about how slow we move. Okay, real slow. Now we're going to do it a second time. And again, the important thing when you get the mechanics down is the intention. Third time, just to make sure that the powers of the universe hear us. No evil here. Together, sing. Ah. Switch. We're going to have our right hand pointing down, our left hand pointing up, and we're going to make circles in the opposite direction, sunwise, bringing in blessing. Real slow. Time with intention, bringing light to any place of darkness in ourselves or in the world. God. Now stand still and put your hands over your heart and let it both come in. The light and the darkness held together. Your seat just for a moment. Thank you. So that's St. Columba, 597, heading out of Ireland in his little Cork with his band of brothers he took with him. And this is into the North Sea. This is horrible waters. They would throw their oars overboard and say, "We're going to be taken where Providence wants us to go." Wow. And they ended up on Iona. And that's why Iona is such a sacred island. And it was these kinds of prayers and this kind of tradition that Columba carried with him. So as we go into our break, I just want to say a word about our center. Judith nicely introduced us. This is our 20th anniversary, a year that we're finishing. Our main work is called Sacred Art of Living and Dying. These are training certification programs we do all over the world, Dublin to California and everywhere in between. If anybody's interested in those, there's some brochures there on the table. We've done these programs here in Santa Barbara over the years. The Anantara Project is our deep end internship that we created with John O'Donohue, and I'll talk to you a little bit about that after our break. And the Soul and Science of Caregiving is a new online program where you could do all of our programs if you have Wi-Fi access. And there's wonderful teachers there, and all of these traditions are there embodied in simple 5-minute video courses. So for nurses, social workers, doctors, and anybody, you can enjoy those courses. And the book that I wrote that embodies a lot of this tradition was called The American Book of Dying. And as it's been translated into more and more languages, it's now become the American Book of Living and Dying. I use the word Anamkara over 700 times in the book because I wanted to get that word into our vocabulary, you see. So if you would like, if you're interested, we have some copies of the book there. I'll be happy to sign them. And we have those raffle tickets to our June West of Ireland pilgrimage in honor of John O'Donohue. And if you've ever wanted to go for 10 days and stay in a thatched Irish 200-year-old cottage with turf fires, utterly charming, and have medieval banquets and see the ancient sites, we love that trip. And we have reserved two places for people who will win with the raffle. So I'm not here to heavy promote, but just to let you know that's a possibility. Let's take our break and come back in about 15 minutes, okay? Thank you.